This is Audible.
Damaged by Kathy Glass. Read by Danica Fairman. In Britain today, there are over 75,000 children in the care of their local authority. These are the lucky ones. Concealed behind this figure are countless others, defiled, abused, and undiscovered by social services, often until it's too late. This book tells the story of my relationship with one of these children, an 8-year-old girl called Jodie. I was her foster carer, and she was the most disturbed child I had ever looked after. I hope my story will provide an insight into the often hidden world of foster care and the social services. Certain details, including names, places and dates, have been changed to protect the innocent. Chapter 1. Emotional blackmail. The phone rang. It was Jill, my link worker from the fostering agency. "Kathy, it's not two carers, but five," she said. "Five since coming into care 4 months ago." "Good heavens!" I was astonished. "And she's only 8. That must have taken some doing. What's she been up to?" "I'm not sure yet, but social services want a pre-placement meeting to be certain she doesn't have another move. Are you still interested?" "I don't know enough not to be." "When?" "Tomorrow at 10. "All right. See you there. What's her name?" "Jodie." "Thanks, Kathy. If you can't do it, no one can." I warmed to the flattery. It was nice to be appreciated after all this time. Jill and I had been working together now for 4 years and had established a good relationship. As a link worker for Home Finders Fostering Agency, Jill was the bridge between the foster carers and social workers dealing with a particular case. She coordinated the needs of the social services with the foster carers and provided support and help as it was needed. An inexperienced foster carer often needed a lot of backup and explanations of the system from their link worker. As Jill and I had been working together for some time, and I was an experienced foster carer, we were used to each other and got on well. If Jill thought I was up to the task, then I was sure she meant it. But a pre-placement meeting, it had to be bad. Usually the children just arrived, with a brief introduction if they'd come from another carer, or with only the clothes they stood in if they'd come from home. I'd had plenty of experience of both, but none at all of a pre-placement meeting. Usually there was a meeting between everyone involved in the case as soon as the child had been placed in foster care, but I'd never been to one held beforehand. It was my first inkling of how unusual this case was. The following morning, we went about our normal, quiet routine of everyone getting up and dressed and having breakfast, and then the children made their way off to school. I had 2 children of my own, Adrian, who was 17, and Paula, the youngest, at 13. Lucy, who had joined the family as a foster placement 2 years ago, was 15 and now a permanent member of our family, just like a daughter to me and a sister to Adrian and Paula. She was a success story. She had come to me hurt and angry and had, over time, learnt to trust again and eventually settled down to a normal existence where she had only the usual teenage angst to fret about instead of the turmoil she had known as a child. I was proud of her, and she was a testament to my belief that love, kindness, attention and firm boundaries are the basis of what any child needs to flourish. As I saw the children off to school that morning, I felt a twinge of apprehension. The child I was going to learn about today would most certainly need all those things in abundance, and if I took her on, I would have to be prepared to say goodbye to my relatively peaceful, steady routine for a while until she learnt to trust me and settle down, just as Lucy had. But that was the point of fostering. It wasn't easy by any means, but the rewards were so enormous. Besides, I had fostered almost continuously for over 20 years now, and wasn't sure I could really remember what life before it had been like. Once the children had left, I went upstairs and quickly changed from my joggers into a pair of smart navy trousers and a jumper, and headed for the social services offices. I'd been going there for years now, and the journey there was as familiar as the one to my own house. I also knew the drab grey decor, fluorescent lighting and air of busy activity, and only just contained chaos very well indeed. "Kathy, hello!" As I entered the reception area, Jill came forward to meet me. She'd been waiting for my arrival and walked up to me with a welcoming smile. "Hi, Jill, how are you?" "Oh, fine, thanks. You're looking well." "Yes, life is good at the moment. The children are doing well, completely wrapped up in their lives and in their schools. Time for another challenge, I suppose." I smiled at her. "We'd better get along to this meeting. I think they're ready for us." Jill led me along the corridor to the meeting room. As we entered the room, it was obvious at once that this was a big case. There were already about a dozen people sitting round the enormous oblong mahogany table. What did it mean? From what Jill had told me, I could tell that this was not a run-of-the-mill fostering situation. Not many children get through 5 carers in 4 months, but then no child was ever run-of-the-mill. They were always unique and their troubles distinctly their own. Removing a child from its parents was never going to be a humdrum, everyday event. It was always traumatic, emotional, and difficult. Nevertheless, something told me that this was far more complex than anything I'd yet encountered. I felt another stab of apprehension, like I had when Jill first told me about the case the day before, but I was also interested. What could this child be like to warrant so much involvement from so many people? Jill and I took the 2 vacant chairs at the far end, and I felt every eye was on me, assessing my suitability. The chairman was Dave Mumby, the social services team leader, and he began the round of introductions. On his left was Sally, the guardian ad litem. She was appointed by the courts to represent Jodie's interests. The lady next to her introduced herself as Nicola, Jodie's home tutor. Home tutor? Why isn't the child in school? I wondered. Next was Gary, Jodie's current social worker. He explained that he was about to leave the case and hand Jodie over to Eileen, who was sitting next to him. I looked at Eileen carefully. If I was going to take Jodie, then Eileen and I would have to work closely together. At first glance, she was nondescript, a woman in her 40s with an unruffled and calm air about her. So far, so good. I wasn't surprised that I was already witnessing a change of social worker. It happened all the time. It was the nature of the job that people had to move on, but it was unfortunate for the children and families involved, who were always having to learn new faces, build trust and forge fresh relationships with endless strangers. Although I knew it was something that couldn't be altered and was just part of the system with all its flaws, nonetheless I felt for Jodie. Changing social worker would mean yet more disruption for her, and I wondered how many social workers she'd been through already. Next, Deirdre introduced herself. She was the agency link worker for Jodie's current foster carers. Then it was my turn, and the eyes of everyone around the table turned to me. I looked around the table, meeting the various gazes. "I'm Kathy Glass," I said, as clearly and confidently as I could. "I'm a foster carer from Home Finders Fostering Agency." There wasn't much more I could add at this stage, when I knew so little about what was going on, so I passed on to Jill. After Jill came someone from the accounts department, followed by a member of the local authority's placement team. As they spoke, I looked over at Gary, Jodie's current social worker. He was young and could only have been in his mid-20s. How successful had he been at forging a relationship with Jodie? I wondered. Perhaps Eileen, as a woman, would fare better at empathising with the little girl, so the change of social worker might be for the better in this case. I hoped so. Once the introductions were complete, Dave thanked us for coming and gave a brief outline of what had been happening, or, to use the correct terminology, the case history to date. I warmed to Dave immediately. He was gently spoken but forthright and looked directly at me as he spoke. I made a mental note of the salient points. Jodie had been on the at-risk register since birth, which meant that social services had been monitoring the family for 8 years. Although there had been suspicions of emotional and physical abuse by Jodie's parents, no steps had been taken to remove her or her younger brother Ben and sister Chelsea. Then, 4 months ago, Jodie had started a house fire by setting light to her pet dog. I shivered at this, struck by the peculiar cruelty of such an act, and that had been the catalyst for social services to take her and her siblings into care. Ben and Chelsea had both been placed with foster carers and were doing well, but Jodie exhibited very challenging behaviour. I heard Dave deliver this euphemism and raised my eyebrows. All foster carers knew what that really stood for. It meant completely out of control. "I think it would be useful," said Dave, looking at me, "for you to hear from her social worker now. Gary's been on the case for 2 years. Feel free to ask any questions." Despite his youth, Gary was confident and methodical as he gave me an overview of Jodie and her family. "I'm afraid that the general picture isn't good, as you'd expect. There's severe disruption inside the family. Jodie's mother is an intravenous drug user and her father is an alcoholic. In recent years, Jodie's suffered a number of injuries while at home, including burns, scalds, cuts, bruises and a broken finger. All of these were recorded at hospital, and although it was suspected that some of the injuries were non-accidental, it was impossible to prove that this was the case." Gary went on with his tale of neglect and misery, while I concentrated on absorbing the facts. It was an appalling case history, but I'd heard similar stories many times before. Nevertheless, it never ceased to amaze and horrify me that people could treat their children with such cruelty and indifference, and I was already feeling for this poor little girl. How could any child grow and be normal in such circumstances, and with such parents as her role models? Gary continued. "Jodie's no longer in school because of the recent moves, which is why she's been assigned a home tutor. She has learning difficulties and a statement of special needs." That was straightforward enough. I was used to looking after children with developmental delays and learning difficulties. I suspected that Gary was giving me the censored version of Jodie's case history. In all my years of fostering, I'd never heard of a child going through 5 carers in 4 months. When he paused and looked at me, I seized my opportunity. "It would be helpful if you could tell me the makeup of the families of the previous carers," I said, hoping to discover clues to explain why Jodie had gone through so many so fast. "How many children did they have, and were they older or younger? Had the carers had experience with this type of child before?" Gary coughed and looked a little shifty. "The previous placement breakdowns were purely circumstantial," he said. "One of the couples were first-time carers, and Jodie should never have been placed with them. That was an error on our part, and it's no surprise that it didn't work out." That was fair enough, but as he went through the other placements, he sounded unconvincing to my ears. The others had all been experienced professionals, and yet one couple had lasted only 3 days. Gary's explanation that circumstances were to blame was clearly a damage limitation exercise for Jodie's sake, so that I didn't get frightened off. Deirdre, who was the link worker representing Jodie's present foster carers, felt obliged to speak up in their defence. After all, if Jodie was as harmless as Gary was making out, it didn't exactly reflect very well on their ability to cope. "Jodie has delayed development," she said. "In most respects, she acts like a 3- or 4-year-old rather than an 8-year-old. She throws terrible tantrums and is consistently aggressive and uncooperative. Her behaviour is violent, abusive and destructive. Even though she's only been with Hillary and Dave a short time, she's already broken a number of objects, including a solid wooden door." I raised my eyebrows. Quite a feat for an 8-year-old. But Deirdre wasn't finished yet, and she went on with her litany of Jodie's faults and shortcomings. Jodie's carers had described her as cold, calculating, manipulative, very rude, and totally unlikable. Harsh words to pin on a little girl. Surely I thought someone could say something nice about her, even if it was only that she liked her food. Children in care tend to eat ravenously because in the past many of them haven't known when the next meal would arrive. But no, not so much as she does like her chocolate. It appeared that Jodie did not have a single endearing feature. Instead, there was just a list of transgressions, with a footnote that her present carers had found her physically frightening. Jodie was a big girl, and she had threatened them. I looked at Jill and we exchanged glances. Threatened them? I thought to myself. But she's only 8 years old. How dangerous can she be? I began to feel as though I was on Jodie's side. What must it be like having everyone dislike you so vehemently? No wonder she wasn't able to settle anywhere. The next person to speak was Sally, the guardian ad litem, who briefly outlined the legal position. Jodie had been taken into the care of social services under what is known as an interim care order. That meant she'd been removed from home against the parents' wishes and was now in the temporary care of the local authority. Proceedings to decide Jodie's future were now beginning. If the court judged that she was better off at home and all the fears for her safety there were put to rest, then she would be returned to her parents' care. If not, and the court still considered that she would be in danger if returned home, her care order would become a full care order, and Jodie would be permanently removed from her parents to long-term fostering, adoption, or, the least likely option, some kind of residential care home. This whole process is lengthy and complicated, and while it is supposed to take as little time as possible, it usually takes at least a year, sometimes longer, before the court comes to a final decision. When Sally had finished, she was followed by the home tutor, Nicola, who explained that she'd been teaching Jodie for a month, using material that was working towards Key Stage 1, which is designed for preschool children. This might sound shocking, but in my experience, it was not unusual. I had, in the past, cared for children who couldn't read or write long after their peers had mastered the 3 R's. A difficult background and home life often seems to produce children who are unable to learn as quickly as those from a stable family. Next, the finance representative confirmed that funding would be available to continue the tutoring until a school had been found. I glanced at the clock on the wall. Nearly an hour had passed. Everyone had had their say, and Dave was looking hopefully at Jill. "If Kathy doesn't take her," he said, "our only option will be a residential unit." This smacked of emotional blackmail, and Jill rose to my defence. "We'll need to consider what's been said. I'll discuss it with Kathy and let you know tomorrow." "We need to know today," said Deirdre bluntly. "She has to be moved by midday tomorrow. They're adamant." There was silence around the table. We were all thinking the same thing. Were these foster carers as unprofessional as they sounded? Or had Jodie somehow driven them to this level of desperation? "Even so," said Jill firmly, "we'll need time to discuss it. While I haven't heard anything that would make me advise Kathy against it, she's very experienced. The decision must be hers." She looked sideways at me. I felt everyone's eyes on me and a desperate desire to hear that I would be willing to take this little girl on. So far, I had heard from Gary that she was an innocent victim whose extraordinary record of getting through carers was nothing to do with her, and from Deirdre that she was a little devil incarnate whose size, strength, and sheer nastiness were completely out of proportion to her age. The truth, I felt, must lie somewhere in between. Even taking a balanced view, however, I could see that Jodie was a handful, to say the least. I was unsure. Was I ready to take on a child with behavioural problems at this level? Could I, and more importantly, could my family, take on the kind of disruption it would surely involve? I couldn't help quailing a little at the thought of embracing the sort of challenge I was sure this child would pose. But on the other hand, my formula of love, kindness and attention mixed with firmness had not let me down yet, and when all was said and done, Jodie was only a child, a little girl who had been given a terrible start in life and who deserved the chance to begin again and have a little of the happiness every child needed. Could I really let her face the alternative? Now that I'd heard her story, could I really walk away? I knew at that moment that I couldn't. I had to give her that chance. As soon as I'd walked into that room, I'd known in my heart that I would take Jodie. I wouldn't be able to turn my back on her. "She's too young to go into a residential unit," I said, meeting Dave's look. "I'll take her and give it my best shot." "Are you sure?" asked Jill, concerned. I nodded, and there was an audible sigh of relief, particularly from the accounts lady. It costs upwards of £3,000 a week to keep a child in a residential unit, so getting me to take her for £250 a week was a good piece of business. "That's wonderful, Kathy," said Dave, beaming. "Thank you. We all think very highly of you, as you know, and we're delighted that you're willing to take this one on." There was a murmur of agreement and a general feeling of a burden being lifted. The meeting was over. For now, the problem of Jodie was solved. Everyone stood up, gathered their things and prepared to get back to work, move on to other cases and think about other situations. But for me, a few words and a snap decision had changed my life. For me, the problem of Jodie was only just beginning. Chapter 2. The Road to Jodie. I had started fostering 20 years before I had even had my own children. One day I was flicking through the paper when I saw one of those adverts. You might have seen them yourself. There was a black-and-white, fuzzy photograph of a child and a question along the lines of, "Could you give little Bobby a home?" For some reason it caught my eye, and once I'd seen it, I couldn't stop thinking about it. I don't consider myself a sentimental person, but for some reason I couldn't get the picture out of my mind. I talked about it with my husband. We knew we wanted a family of our own at some point, and I was looking forward to that, but in the meantime, I knew that I could give a good home to a child who needed it. I'd always felt a bond with children and had once had ambitions to teach. "We've got the room," I said, "and I know I would love working with children. Why don't we at least find out a little bit more about it?" So I picked up the phone, replied to the advertisement, and before long we found ourselves on an induction course that introduced us to the world of foster care. Then, after we'd satisfied all the requirements and done the requisite training, we took in our first foster child, a troubled teenager in need of a stable home for a while. That was it. I was hooked. Fostering, I discovered, is by no means easy. If a carer goes into it expecting to take in a little orphan Annie or an Anne of Green Gables, then he or she is in for a nasty shock. The sweet, mop-headed child who has had a little bad luck and only needs a bit of love and affection to thrive and blossom and spread happiness in the world doesn't exist. Foster children don't come into your home wide-eyed and smiling. They tend to be withdrawn because of what has happened to them and will often be distant, angry, and hard to reach, which is hardly surprising. In worse cases, they can be verbally or even physically aggressive and violent. The only constant factor is that each one is different and that they need attention and kindness to get through their unhappiness. It is never an easy ride. The first year of fostering was by no means easy for me, and come to think of it, no year since has been what I would call easy. But by the end of it, I knew I wanted to continue. A foster carer will generally know almost at once if it is something they want to carry on doing or not, and certainly will by the end of that first year. I'd found something I had a talent for, and that was extremely rewarding, and I wanted to carry on, even while I had my own children. I found that the difference I made to my foster children's lives, even if it was a small one, stayed with me. It was not that I was the most selfless being since Mother Teresa, or that I was particularly saintly. I believe that we do these things for our own ends, and mine was the satisfaction I got from the whole process of making things better for children who needed help. While my children were small, I fostered teenagers, as it's usually recommended that you take in children who are at a different stage to your own. As Adrian and Paula grew up, I began to take in younger ones, which meant that I never had to deal with the kind of serious drug problems that are endemic among a lot of teenagers these days, for which I am most grateful. My two grew up knowing nothing other than having foster children living with us, so it was something they accepted completely. Of course, when they were little, they were sometimes frustrated at having to share me with other children. Foster children, by definition, need a lot of time and attention, and sometimes that felt never-ending to my two. After a day of pouring my energies into fostering, with its meetings and training, I would then have paperwork to see to, and that took its toll on the amount of time I had left over for my own family. But no matter how much they resented missing out on some of my time, they never took it out on the foster children who shared our home. Somehow, they seemed to understand that these children had come from difficult backgrounds and that they had had a rough start. In their own way, my children were sympathetic and did their best to make life a bit easier for whichever troubled child was living with us. It's something I've noticed in other children besides my own. There is often a lot more understanding and empathy there than we would expect. Adrian and Paula have certainly had to put up with a lot over the years, particularly when my husband and I divorced, but they have never complained about all the troubled youngsters coming and going in their home. Over the years, we've experienced all types of children, most of whom have exhibited challenging behaviour. The majority of children who come to me have suffered from neglect of one sort or another, and funnily enough, that is something I find relatively easy to understand. When parents have addictions to drink or drugs or suffer from mental problems, they are obviously in no fit state to care for their children properly and look after their needs in a way they might be able to if they could overcome their problems. This kind of parenting is not purposefully cruel in the way that actual physical and sexual abuse is cruel. It is a sad side effect of a different problem. The ideal outcome is that a child will be returned to its parents once the factors that cause the neglect, such as addiction, have been remedied. A child who has suffered from neglect will have had a miserable time and can arrive in my house in a very troubled state. They can be full of brashness and bravado, which is usually a disguise for a complete lack of self-esteem. They can often be out-and-out naughty as a result of having no boundaries or parental guidance at home and as a way of seeking attention. Their anger and resentment can stem from the unpredictable nature of life at home, where nothing was ever certain. Would Mum be too drunk to function today? Would Dad be spaced out or violent? And where the borders between who was the adult and who was the child, and who was caring for whom, were often blurred. They may try to destroy things, or steal, or be manipulative and self-seeking. And to be honest, when you know what some of them have had to put up with in their short lives, who can blame them? The way that I've found is usually best with children from this kind of background is fairly simple. I provide stability and a positive environment in which good behaviour is rewarded with praise. Most children desire approval and want to be liked, and most are able to unlearn negative behaviour patterns and accept different ones when they realise how much better and easier life is with the new order. For many of them, a regular routine provides a blessed relief to the chaos and unpredictability of life at home, and they soon respond to a calm, positive environment where they know certain things will happen at certain times. Something as simple as knowing for sure when and where the next meal is coming from can provide an anchor for troubled children who've only ever known uncertainty and disappointment. Routine is safe. It is possible to get things right inside a routine, and getting things right is lovely when it means being praised, approved of, and rewarded. Of course, simple as it may sound, it is never easy and straightforward. And sometimes children come to me who've suffered much more severe levels of abuse and who need much more professional help to get through their experiences. Many have learning difficulties and special needs. Some are removed from home too late when they're teenagers and have suffered so much that they are never able to get over what has happened. They're not able to respond to a positive environment in the way a younger child might, and their futures look a lot bleaker. Nevertheless, almost all my fostering experiences have been good ones, and the child has left our home in a better place than when they arrived. As I drove home from the meeting at Social Services that day, having agreed to take on Jodie, I knew that this child might be more of a handful than most, and wondered how best to tell the children about our new addition. They wouldn't be best pleased. We'd had children before with challenging behaviour, so they knew what was in store. I thought of Lucy, who'd been with us for nearly 2 years and was very well settled. I hoped Jodie's disturbed outbursts wouldn't set her back. Adrian, at 17, kept pretty much to himself, unless there was a crisis or he couldn't find his shirt in the morning. It was Paula I was most worried about. She was a sensitive, nervous child, and even though Jodie was 5 years younger than her, there was a risk she could be intimidated. Emotionally damaged children can wreak havoc in a family, even a well-integrated one. My children had always reacted well to the other children who had joined our family, even though we'd had a few rocky times, and I had no reason to think that this time would be any different. I suspected the children wouldn't be surprised by my news. It had been a few weeks since our last foster child had left, so it was time for a new challenge. I usually took a break of a couple of weeks between placements to refresh myself mentally and physically and give everyone time to regroup. I also needed to recover from the sadness of saying goodbye to someone I'd become close to. Even when a child leaves on a high note, having made excellent progress and perhaps returning home to parents who are now able to provide a loving and caring environment, there is still a period when I mourn their going. It's a mini bereavement and something I've never got used to, even though a week or two later I'd be revved up and ready to go again. I decided to raise the subject of Jodie over dinner, which was where most of our discussions took place. Although I consider myself liberal, I do insist that the family eat together in the evenings and at weekends, as it's the only part of the day when we're all together. For dinner that night, I served shepherd's pie, which was the children's favourite. As they tucked in, I adjusted my voice to a light and relaxed tone. "You remember I mentioned I was going to a pre-placement meeting today?" I said, aware they probably wouldn't remember because no one had been listening when I'd said it. "They told me all about a little girl who needs a home. Well, I've agreed to take her. She's called Jodie and she's 8. I glanced round the table for a reaction, but there was barely a flicker. They were busy eating. Even so, I knew they were listening. "I'm afraid she's had a rough start and a lot of moves, so she's very unsettled. She's had a terrible home life and she's already had some foster carers. Now they're thinking of sending her to a residential unit if they can't find someone to take her in, and you can imagine how horrible that would be for her. You know, a children's home," I added, labouring the point. Lucy and Paula looked up and I smiled bravely. "Like me," said Lucy innocently. She had moved around a lot before she finally settled down with us, so she knew all about the disruption of moving. No, your moves were because of your relatives not being able to look after you. It had nothing to do with your behaviour." I paused, wondering if the discreet message had been picked up. It had. "What's she done?" Adrian growled in his newly developed masculine voice. "Well, she has tantrums and breaks things when she's upset, but she's still young, and I'm sure if we all pull together, we'll be able to turn her around." "Is she seeing her mum?" asked Paula, her eyes wide, imagining what for her would be the worst-case scenario, a child not seeing her mother. "Yes, and her dad. It will be supervised contact twice a week at the social services." "When is she coming?" asked Lucy. "Tomorrow morning." They all glanced at me and then at each other. Tomorrow there would be a new member of the family and, from the sounds of it, not an easy one either. I knew it must be unsettling. "Don't worry," I reassured them. "I'm sure she'll be fine." I realized I'd better be quick, as once dinner was over, they'd vanished to their rooms, so I cut straight to the chase and reminded them of the safer caring rules that were always in place when a new foster child arrived. Now, remember, there are a lot of unknowns here, so you need to be careful for your own protection. If she wants you to play, it's down here, not upstairs. And Adrian, don't go into her room, even if she asks you to open a window. If there's anything like that, call me or one of the girls. And remember, no physical contact games like piggyback until we know more. And obviously, don't let her in your room, okay? Yes, Mom, he groaned, looking even more uncomfortably adolescent. He'd heard it all before, of course. There are standard codes of practice that apply in the homes of all foster carers, and my lot were well aware of how to behave. But Adrian could sometimes be too trusting for his own good. And obviously, all of you, I said, addressing the three of them, let me know if she confides anything about her past that gives you cause for concern. She'll probably forge a relationship with you before she does with me. They all nodded. I decided that that was enough. They'd got the general picture, and they were pretty clued up. The children of foster carers tend to grow up quickly as a result of the issues and challenges they're exposed to, but not as quickly as the fostered children themselves, whose childhoods have often been sacrificed on the pyre of daily survival. After dinner, as expected, the children disappeared to their rooms and the peace of another quiet evening descended on the house. It had gone off as well as I could have expected, and I felt pleased with their maturity and acceptance of the situation. So far, so good, I thought, as I loaded the dishwasher. Then I settled down myself to watch the television, with no idea when I'd next have the opportunity. Chapter 3. The Arrival. It was a wet and cold spring day in April. Rain hammered on the windows as I prepared for Jodie's arrival. She was due at midday, but I was sure she'd be early. I stood in what was to be her new bedroom and tried to see it through the eyes of a child. Was it appealing and welcoming? I'd pinned brightly coloured posters of animals to the walls and bought a new duvet cover with a large print of a teddy bear on it. I'd also propped a few soft toys on the bed, although I was sure that Jodie, having been in care for a while, was likely to have already accumulated some possessions. The room looked bright and cheerful, the kind of place that an 8-year-old girl would like as her bedroom. All it needed now was its new resident. I took a final look around, then came out and closed the door, satisfied I'd done my best. Continuing along the landing, I closed all the bedroom doors. When it came to showing her around, it would be important to make sure she understood privacy, and this would be easier if the ground rules had been established right from the start. Downstairs, I filled the kettle and busied myself in the kitchen. It was going to be a hectic day, and even after all these years of fostering, I was still nervous. The arrival of a new child is a big event for a foster family, perhaps as much as for the child herself. I hoped Jill would arrive early so that the two of us could have a quiet chat and offer moral support before the big arrival. Just before 11:30, the doorbell rang. I opened the door to find Gary, soaking wet from his walk from the station. I ushered him in, offered him a towel and coffee, and left him mopping his brow in the lounge while I returned to the kitchen. Before the kettle had a chance to boil, the bell rang again. I went to the door, hoping to see Jill on the doorstep. No such luck. It was the link worker from yesterday, Deirdre, along with another woman who was smiling bravely. "This is Anne, my colleague," said Deirdre, dispensing with small talk. "And this is Jodie." I looked down, but Jodie was hiding behind Anne, and all I could see was a pair of stout legs in bright red trousers. "Hi, Jodie," I said brightly. "I'm Kathy. It's very nice to meet you. Come on in." She must have been clinging to Anne's coat and decided she wasn't going anywhere, as Anne was suddenly pulled backwards, nearly losing her balance. "Don't be silly," snapped Deirdre, and made a grab behind her colleague. Jodie was quicker and, I suspected, stronger, for Anne took another lurch, this time sideways. Thankfully, our old cat decided to put in a well-timed appearance, sauntering lazily down the hall. I took my cue. "Look who's come to see you, Jodie!" I cried, the excitement in my voice out of all proportion to our fat and lethargic Moggy. "It's Tosha! She's come to say hello!" It worked. She couldn't resist a peep. A pair of grey-blue eyes set in a broad forehead peered out from around Anne's waist. Jodie had straw-blonde hair set in pigtails, and it was obvious from her outfit alone that her previous carers had lost control. Under her coat she was wearing a luminous green T-shirt, red dungarees and wellies. No sensible adult would have dressed her like this. Clearly, Jodie was used to having her own way. With her interest piqued, she decided to take a closer look at the cat and gave Anne another shove, sending them both stumbling over the doorstep and into the hall. Deirdre followed, and the cat sensibly nipped out. I quickly closed the door.
"It's gone!"
Jodie yelled, her face pinched with anger. "Don't worry, she'll be back soon. Let's get you out of your wet coat." And before the loss of the cat could escalate into a scene, I undid her zip and tried to divert her attention. "Gary's in the lounge waiting for you." She stared at me for a moment, looking as though she'd really like to hit me. But the mention of Gary, a familiar name in an unfamiliar setting, drew her in. She wrenched her arms free of the coat and stomped heavily down the hall before disappearing into the lounge.
"I want that cat!"
she growled at Gary. The two women exchanged a look which translated as, "Heaven help this woman, how soon can we leave?" I offered them coffee and showed them through to the lounge. Jodie had found the box of Lego and was now sitting cross-legged in the middle of the floor, making a clumsy effort to force two pieces together. Returning to the kitchen, I took down four mugs and started to spoon in some instant coffee. I heard heavy footsteps, then Jodie appeared in the doorway. She was an odd-looking child, not immediately endearing, but I thought this was largely because of the aggressive way she held her face and body, as though continually on guard.
"What's in here?"
she demanded, pulling open a kitchen drawer. "Cutlery," I said needlessly, as the resulting clatter had announced itself.
"What?"
she demanded, glaring at me. "Cutlery, you know, knives, forks and spoons. We'll eat with those later when we have dinner. You'll have to tell me what you like." Leaving that drawer, she moved on to the next, and the next, intent on opening them all. I let her look around. I wasn't concerned about her inquisitiveness. That was natural. What worried me more was the anger in all her movements. I'd never seen it so pronounced before. With all the drawers opened and the kettle boiled, I took out a plate and a packet of biscuits.
"I want one!"
she demanded, lunging for the packet. I gently stopped her. "In a moment. First, I'd like you to help me close these drawers. Otherwise, we'll bump into them, won't we?" She looked at me with a challenging and defiant stare. Had no one ever stopped her from doing anything, or was she deliberately testing me? There was a few seconds' pause, a standoff, while she considered my request. I noticed how overweight she was. It was clear she'd either been comfort-eating or had been given food to keep her quiet. Probably both. "Come on," I said encouragingly, and started to close the drawers. She watched, then, with both hands, slammed the nearest drawer with all her strength. "Gently, like this," I demonstrated. But she didn't offer any more assistance, and I didn't force the issue. She'd only just arrived, and she had at least compromised by closing one. "Now the biscuits," I said, arranging them on the plate. "I'd like your help. I'm sure you're good at helping, aren't you?" Again she fixed me with her challenging, almost derisory stare. But there was a hint of intrigue, a spark of interest in the small responsibility I was about to bestow on her. "Jodie, I'd like you to carry this into the lounge and offer everyone a biscuit. Then take one for yourself, all right? I placed the plate squarely in her chubby, outstretched hands and wondered what the chances were of it arriving intact. The digestives pitched to the left as she turned, and she transferred the plate to her left hand, clamping the right on top of the biscuits, which was at least safe, if not hygienic. I followed with the tray of drinks, pleased that she'd done as I'd asked. I handed out the mugs of coffee as the doorbell rang, signalling our last arrival. Jodie jumped up and made a dash for the door. I quickly followed. It's not good practice for a child to be answering the door, even if guests are expected. I explained this to Jodie, then we opened it together. Jill stood on the doorstep. She was smiling encouragingly and looked down at the sullen-faced child staring defiantly up at her. "Hi," said Jill brightly. "You must be Jodie."
"I wanted to do it,"
protested Jodie before stomping back down the hall to rejoin the others. "Is everything all right?" Jill asked as she came in. "Okay, so far. No major disasters yet, anyway." I took Jill's coat and she went through to the lounge. I fetched another coffee and the paperwork began. There's a lot of form filling when a child is placed with new carers and a lot of coffee. Gary was writing furiously. "I've only just completed the last move," he said cheerfully, "not to mention the three-day one before that. Is it Kathy with a C?" I confirmed that it was, then gave him my postcode and my doctor's name and address. Jodie, who'd been reasonably content watching him and had obviously been party to the process many times before, decided it was time to explore again. She hauled herself up and disappeared into the kitchen. I couldn't allow her to be in there alone. Quite apart from the risk of her raiding the cupboards, there were any number of implements which could have been harmful in the wrong hands. I called her, but she didn't respond. I walked in and found her trying to yank open the cupboard under the sink, which was protected by a child lock, as it contained the various cleaning products. "Come on, Jodie, leave that for now. Let's go into the lounge," I said. "I'll show you around later. We'll have plenty of time once they've gone."
"I want a drink,"
she demanded, pulling harder on the cupboard door.
"OK, but it's not in there."
I opened the correct cupboard, where I kept a range of squashes. She peered in at the row of brightly coloured bottles. "Orange, lemon, blackcurrant or apple?" I offered.
"Coke,"
she demanded. "I'm sorry, we don't have Coke. It's very bad for your teeth." Not to mention hyperactivity, I thought to myself.
"How about apple?
Paula, my youngest daughter, likes apple. You'll meet her later."
"That one."
She tried to clamber onto the work surface to retrieve the bottle. I took down the bottle of blackcurrant and poured the drink, then carried it through and placed it on the coffee table. I drew up the child-sized wicker chair, which is usually a favourite.
"This is just the right size for you," I said. "Your very own seat."
Jodie ignored me, grabbed her glass and plonked herself in the place I'd vacated on the sofa next to Jill. I sat next to Gary, while Jill pacified Jodie with a game on her mobile phone. I watched her for a few moments. So this was the child who was going to be living with us. It was hard to make much of her so early on. Most children displayed difficult behaviour in their first few days in a new home. Nevertheless, there was an unusual air about her that I couldn't quite understand. It was anger, of course, and stubbornness, mixed with something else that I wasn't sure I'd seen before. Only time would tell, I thought. I observed Jodie's uncoordinated movements and the way her tongue lolled over her bottom lip. I noted almost guiltily how it gave her a dull, vacant air, and reminded myself that she was classified as having only mild learning difficulties rather than severe. A quarter of an hour later, all the placement forms had been completed. I signed them and Gary gave me my copies. Deirdre and Anne immediately stood to leave.
"We'll unpack the car," said Anne. "There's rather a lot."
Leaving Jodie with Gary and Jill, I quickly put on my shoes and coat, and we got gradually drenched as we went back and forth to the car. Rather a lot turned out to be an understatement. I'd never seen so many bags and hold-alls for a child in care. We stacked them the length of the hall, Then the two women said a quick goodbye to Jody. She ignored them, obviously feeling the rejection. Gary stayed for another 10 minutes, chatting with Jody about me and my home. Then he too made a move to leave.
"I want to come," she grinned, sidling up to him. "Take me with you. I want to go in your car."
"I don't have a car," said Gary gently. "And you're staying with Kathy. Remember we talked about it? This is your lovely new home now."
He picked up his briefcase and got halfway to the door. Then Jody opened her mouth wide and screamed. It was truly ear-piercing. I rushed over and put my arms around her and nodded to Gary to go. He slipped out and I held her until the noise subsided. There were no tears, but her previously pale cheeks were now flushed and bright red. The last person left was Jill. She came out into the hall and got her coat. "Will you be all right, Kathy?" she asked as she prepared to venture out into the rain. "I'll phone about 5. She knew that the sooner Jody and I were left alone, the sooner she'd settle.
"We'll be fine, won't we, Jody?" I said. "I'll show you around, and then we'll unpack."
I was half expecting another scream, but she just stared at me, blank and uncomprehending. My heart went out to her. She must have felt so lost in what was her 6th home in 4 months. I held her hand as we saw Jill out. Now it was just the two of us. I'd been in this situation many times before, welcoming a confused and hurt little person into my home, waiting patiently as they acclimatized to a new and strange environment, but this felt different somehow. There was something in the blankness in Jody's eyes that was chilling. I hadn't seen it before in a child or an adult. I shook myself mentally. "Come on," I cajoled. "She's a little girl, and you've got 20 years' experience of looking after children. How hard can it be?" I led her back into the living room, and right on cue, Tosha reappeared. I showed Jody the correct way to stroke her, but she lost interest as soon as I'd begun.
"I'm hungry. I want a biscuit."
She made a dash for the kitchen. I followed and was about to explain that too many biscuits aren't good when I noticed a pungent smell. "Jody, do you want the toilet?" I asked casually. She shook her head. "Do you want to do a poo?"
"No,"
she grinned, and before I realised what she was doing, her hand was in her pants and she smeared feces across her face.
"Jody!"
I grabbed her wrist, horrified. She cowered instantly, protecting her face.
"You're going to hit me?"
"No, Jody, of course not. I'd never do that. You're going to have a bath, and next time tell me when you want the toilet. You're a big girl now."
Slowly, I led my new charge up the stairs and she followed, clumsy, lumbering, and her face smeared with excrement. What had I let myself in for? Chapter 4. A new little sister. Foster carers aren't saints. We're just ordinary parents with space in our homes and hearts for one more. But as I turned on the shower and helped Jody out of her clothes and her soiled underwear, I wondered if my heart was truly big enough. I put her under the shower of hot water and began to sponge her down. My stomach lurched as the heat intensified the smell, and I closed my mouth and tried to breathe through my nose. I cleansed her face and hands, then between the folds of pale skin around her middle. Jody was pear-shaped, which is unusual for a child, and she had hips like a middle-aged woman. She was docile, though, lifting her arms in the air and making no effort to help. She seemed to enjoy being treated like a baby. I consoled myself that at least the rest of the family weren't home to witness the new arrival's housewarming trick. I couldn't help feeling puzzled by it. She hadn't been distressed by her accident at all, and it was unlikely that someone of her age had no bowel control and wasn't aware of when they were about to do a poo. So had it been deliberate? Surely not. It was probably anxiety. I helped her out of the bath and wrapped a towel round her. Dry yourself, Jodie, while I put these in the wash. I scooped up the soiled clothes and carried them downstairs to the washing machine. I added a few drops of disinfectant to the soap and turned the dial to 80 degrees. The sound of Jodie talking to herself floated down from the bathroom, and I could hear her muttering isolated words and phrases which didn't string together and didn't make any sense. Returning down the hall, I took the largest suitcase and heaved it upstairs.
"You okay, Jodie?"
I called as I crossed the landing. Silence then.
"Yeah,"
before she lapsed into gobbledygook once again. In her bedroom, I unzipped the case and picked out joggers, a jumper and underwear, and carried them through to the bathroom. She was standing as I'd left her, wrapped in the towel but still dripping wet.
"Come on," I encouraged. "Dry yourself. You're a big girl now."
She shook her head sulkily, and I started patting her dry. She was like a 7-stone infant, and very cumbersome, and I was sure some of this was due to the rolls of fat.
"Don't want those,"
she said, spying the clothes I'd brought in.
"Okay, when you're dry, we'll find some others. You've got lots to choose from. Now come on before you get cold."
She pulled out of the towel and darted naked along the landing to her room, where she began rummaging through the clothes. She held up a pair of pink shorts and a T-shirt. I tried to explain that they weren't suitable for the chilly weather, but I might as well have been talking Russian for all the response I got.
"How about these jeans?" I said, holding them up. "And this blue top is nice and warm. Now find yourself some underwear and get dressed. Come on, quickly."
She held up a pair of knickers and struggled into them, then continued picking over the clothes. She was chattering continuously, but when I tried to join in the conversation, she would stare at me blankly before continuing with her search and the next unintelligible monologue. Finally, she settled on a pair of black trousers and a grey jumper and stood waiting for me to dress her. Just to hurry things along, I gave in to this demand, then began clearing up the heaps of discarded clothes, folding and hanging them in the drawers and wardrobe. Jodie had said nothing about her bedroom, and when I asked if she liked it, she responded with a blank, dismissive stare. She picked up a soft toy and hurled it at the door.
"Not mine! Don't want it!"
Her face screwed up in anger.
"Okay, but don't throw it. I'm sure you've got lots of your own. I'll put these away and find some of yours. You'd prefer that, wouldn't you?"
I gathered up the other toys and moved towards the door.
"Where are you going?"
she demanded, her scowl intensifying.
"To put these away and bring up some of your own toys," I smiled and left,
aware another scene had been narrowly averted.